Astonishing Legends Network.
Hey everybody, welcome back. I just wanted to say a quick hello and a thank you to all the people on the Facebook group. We're having so much fun over there, and you guys are sending me so many really beautiful comments. I just wanted to say thanks to Linda Ray Price, Delure Keller, Anna Shaw, David Stevenson, John Fitzpatrick, Elizabeth Cole, Ellie Behrens, Samantha Cardamon, Daniel Gray, Trish Dabkowski, Megan Macarone, Gareth Hampton, Patrick Smith, Donna Bowden, Kathy Romer, Robin Hinsdale, Sheila Gillum, Sam Begay, Steve Taysom, Jeanette Farrell, Deborah Small, Helen Lyons, Karen Cantwell, Paul Martinez, Adam Tillis, Douglas Stockwell Jr., Claire Mitchell, Michelle Kadarmas Booth, Mike Skull, Emma Holohan, I hope your ears have recovered, and my friend Mike White from the Projection Booth podcast. It's so great to have you around. Thank you, guys. I love seeing you there. I love talking to you there. And for those of you who aren't there yet, come on and join the fun on Facebook. All right, here we go. Miracles by D. Scott Rogo. Miracle, definition. An extraordinary event in the physical world that surpasses all known human powers and is ascribed to a supernatural cause. All book people know this to be true. Sometimes you find the book, sometimes the book finds you. Miracles by D. Scott Rogo, Dial Press, New York, 1982, found me by accident. I started collecting books in college, but things really took off in the late 90s because A, some of those sweet, sweet residuals from Under Siege 2 Dark Territory started to come in, and for the first time in my life, I had just a little extra money to spend, and B, the internet. The internet made book collecting easier and faster. Thanks to a site called Adall.com, I was able to enter a title and immediately search thousands of used and antiquarian bookstores in seconds. That sounded like a commercial. Adall, if you like that, let me know. I can do more. Anyway, suddenly book buying was a breeze. But it was not without its risks. I had ordered a hard-to-find book called Phone Calls from the Dead by D. Scott Rogo and Raymond Bayless. And I'm telling you, it's even scarier than it sounds, and it'll get its own episode soon. The bookstore that had it was in Delaware, so there was no chance I would have ever just found the book while browsing. So this was huge. A book I'd been hunting for years, was going to be in my mailbox in less than a week. Easy sleazy. This was late March 2001. On April 2nd, the universe played a late April Fool's Day joke, and the wrong book arrived. The book was Miracles. The subtitle of Miracles is, quote, "A Parascientific Inquiry into Wondrous Phenomenon." And Rogo, I love you, but I don't think parascientific is a word. It's the kind of word designed to drive skeptics insane. It even bugged me. I felt like it made the book sound unserious just when it was trying to sound serious. Plus, I had no interest in the subject matter. I just wasn't intrigued by the idea of people bleeding from the palms of their hands for no reason, or being healed by a statue in a grotto in France. In fact, I wasn't just not intrigued, I was actively annoyed. I was totally down with seeing strange things. I just hated the instant explanation, the obvious and predictable assigning of meaning, especially when it seemed designed to prop up organized religion. This was the realm of the true believer. This was as bad as a skeptic's instant instinctual dismissal of strange phenomenon. Both sides were rushing to an answer and skipping over the best part of any mystery, the question. Where was the wonder? As in, I wonder what this is. I wonder how it got here. I wonder what it means. Stand at the doorway of a question as long as you can before crossing over the threshold into an answer, because if it's a real mystery, your need to step into an answer will be guided by your conscious or unconscious beliefs. In other words, you'll end up with the answer you want, which may not be the answer that is correct. I called the bookstore in Delaware, only to find that the listing for Phone Calls from the Dead was a clerical hiccup. That book had been sold months ago and should no longer have been on the website. The book Miracles had been sent to me as the result of a second error, this one human, right author, wrong title. They told me to send it back for a full refund. I said I would, and then, like every other human being on Earth, I put off the chore and felt bad about it, and still did nothing, and continued to feel bad in a never-ending loop of self-castigation and laziness. Life went on. Life at that point was great. And terrible. The Mothman prophecies was getting made, and my 9-year marriage was dissolving. I had a lot riding on Mothman. I was at a point where my individual career as a screenwriter was not yet established. The only credit I had was Under Siege 2, Dark Territory, and that was a shared credit with my friend Matt Reeves. Matt's career had moved forward. He had co-written and directed The Pallbearer, and then had co-created Felicity with his friend J.J. Abrams. During that time, I'd been hired to write movies, but none of them had been made. So Mothman, which was my own and felt incredibly personal, also made me feel incredibly vulnerable. If it did well, financially and critically, it could change everything for me. It could establish me in a way screenwriters only dream about. And it would be a validation of me. It would be the thing that all writers and actors and musicians and painters and creative people of all stripes really pray for. Widespread public validation. Not just fame for fame's sake, but a kind of vast acceptance, a warm wave of humanity saying, we see you and we get it and we like it and we like you. For some, it boils down to simple human connection, but for most, and for me, it was supposed to fill a hole left inside me from childhood. It only takes a handful of therapy sessions to understand where the soul pain is and what caused it. Mommy or daddy or both didn't love me correctly or enough. But it takes a lot longer to stop feeling that pain. It's a process of connecting to the child part of yourself that experienced the pain and trying to reassure that inner child that they're not going to die and that the adult version of you will always be there for them. The problem with this slow process is that it is slow. And in the meantime, your soul looks for shortcuts. My shortcut was, become a famous, successful writer, and the love you feel from your fans will make everything okay. My other shortcut was, marry someone that reminds you of your dynamic with your mother and relive a more successful version of your childhood with them. A sort of emotional do-over. Get it right the second time around. A love mulligan. By 2001, I was deep into both shortcuts. One was working, maybe. It all depended on how Mothman was accepted. The other wasn't. My wife was on her own journey, struggling with the echoes of her own childhood. I thought I could be instrumental in solving her problems for her. I thought I could be a savior to her, in a way I couldn't for my own mom, who suffered from depression she never even knew she had, and wouldn't have admitted to under any circumstance. You might think, Rich, it's not fair to your wife to base the success of a marriage on your ability to solve her life. And you'd be right, smartass. But I was white-knuckling my way through my own life, my own anxiety, and self-loathing, and there's only so much you can know about yourself at any given time. But hey, I was in therapy, I was trying. For me, it was a process that was going to take years. The emerging truth was that the slow way is the fast way, and that there were no shortcuts. In 2001, I'd been going to therapy for 5 years, and making a lot of progress. On the outside, I looked pretty much like I do now. A funny, happy, healthy guy pursuing his dreams like a motherfucker. But inside, I was on a very big, old, creaky roller coaster every minute of every day. I hid my fear and took my punches and swallowed my blood, kept making jokes, kept running in the direction of solutions I felt sure would save me. The biggest miracle was, I never turned to booze or drugs for help. And the reason I didn't is because I was too afraid of losing control. I had to solve my world by sheer force of personal will. And for that, I had to be constantly vigilant at all times. I had to handle every person in my life just like I handled my mom, like wet dynamite, because my personal safety depended on it. And I couldn't do that if I was drunk or high. I was always on duty. I was always in control. It all depended on me. And now it all depended on Mothman. If it was a financial and critical success, not only would that fill me with the public love and validation I thought I needed to survive, it would also make me successful. And if I was successful, that meant I was saving both myself and my wife. Success, money, security, I'd save us both in one grand gesture. The scary part was that in reality, I had no control over any of it. I'd written this script, and I was pretty sure that what they shot was what I wrote, but I was never allowed on set. I never dealt with Mark Pellington, the director, or Richard Gere, or Laura Linney, or any of the other amazing actors and crew and craftspeople involved in making what I still thought of exclusively as my movie. I had to hope and pray things worked out. I'd come a long way, but every step closer to the finish line was fraught with increasing danger. I might just pull it off, but I was going to need a miracle. Yeah, I know I keep saying miracle. I'll get back to the book soon enough. Now, meanwhile, I needed a job. I completed all drafts and paid rewrites for every assignment I'd had in the past 2 years, and now I had no income. The release of the Mothman Prophecies was 9 months away, and even then I wouldn't see any money for at least 6 more months after that when the residuals would start coming through. Plus, in what would become a recurring issue in my career, a possible writer's strike was looming. So I was taking every single meeting I could get and pitching on everything, hoping I could line up some paid work before any possible work stoppage. In late April, my agent called about a feature film script in development at Spyglass Films. Would I be interested in doing a quick rewrite? At that point, I was interested in anything. I told him to send it immediately. "I think it's your kind of thing," he said before hanging up. "It's called Miracles." See, I told you I'd get to it. Now, I never connected the script to the book, and as it turns out, the script was not connected to the book. It was its own thing. And it was a wonderful thing. Written by Michael Petroni, it was a romantic drama character piece about a young man preparing to become a priest who is assigned to investigate miracles. His investigation takes him to Newfoundland, where a series of events have the locals convinced that their small fishing town has been blessed by God. The miracles in question seem to center around an eccentric young woman, and as our hero, Paul Callan, spends more and more time investigating her, the more unsure he becomes about his calling to become a priest. It was a magical, charming script that reminded me of Local Hero, and left me totally confused as to why the producers wanted anyone to rewrite a single word of it. And as it turns out, they didn't. The script had become a passion project for Russell Crowe, who intended to star in it as well as direct it. But for reasons I was never too clear on, that deal fell through. But Spyglass had a first-look development deal with Touchstone, the studio that supplied television shows, to Disney's ABC network. Spyglass wanted to get into the television business, and Touchstone was looking for something spooky. Fox's The X-Files was coming to an end, and those viewers would need somewhere to go for their shivers and chills. Spyglass and Touchstone had meetings about all of this, and they thought, well, what if we develop a show that is basically Vatican X-Files? What if we find a writer who could keep the idea of a young priest investigating miracles, but give it a touch of The Exorcist? What if the miracles this young priest investigates have nothing to do with God? What if they weren't miracles at all? This is why they sent me Miracles. Spyglass had read my Mothman Prophecy script and were intrigued. Maybe this is the guy we're looking for. Now, I found all this out from my agent the night before the meeting. I didn't really have time to prepare a pitch, but I knew I needed something to convince them that I was, on a basic, undeniable level, the perfect guy to write this TV pilot. I decided to bring a book along, and I knew just which one. I walked straight into my office and grabbed The Physical Phenomenon of Mysticism by Herbert J. Thurston. You thought I was going to say Miracles by D. Scott Rogo, didn't you? That, my friends, would have been way too obvious. Also, I'd already forgotten I had it. That's right. Two things called miracles arrive in my mailbox in the span of 3 weeks, and I don't make the connection. I really deserve nothing good that has ever happened to me. The Physical Phenomenon of Mysticism, Burns Oates, London, 1952, is a readable but remote scholarly work by Father Herbert Thurston, an English priest of the Roman Catholic Church and a member of the Jesuit order. Thurston sounds like a cool guy. He was one of a vanishing breed, even in the early 1900s, a religious man who realized that to truly be devout was to accept that supernatural things may very well be happening all the time, and those things needed to be sorted into miracles or other. Other was a bit undefined, but the implication was, you know, Satan. Thurston joined the Society for Psychical Research in 1919 and was the guy at the seances wearing the priest collar. He was skeptical of miraculous and purely physical phenomenon, but he didn't rule it out. What made me bring the book to the meeting at Disney was a quote of his that thematically jibed with the heart of the miracle screenplay. Here it is. It's about being an investigator of miracles for the church. Quote, "The role of devil's advocate is a thankless one and does not make for popularity. Indeed, I may confess that when writing, somewhat in the character of a doubting Thomas, I have felt at times, in spite of good intentions, that I was even playing a mean and unworthy part. Why, I have asked myself, should a skeptical line of argument be put forward which may possibly trouble the simple faith of many good people much nearer and dearer to God than I can ever hope to be?" Now, this was a delicious concept, and it played out in Michael Petroni's script. In the very first scene, his young priest in training, Paul Callan, is called to investigate the case of a nun that has been exhumed from her crypt after 100 years, but has experienced no decay. Everyone at the church is pretty excited. "We've got a miracle here. Just think, God loves us. Even better, we might finally get some money to spruce up the chapel." But Paul Callan takes a look around and in about 2 seconds reveals that this miracle is no miracle, and the incorruption of the nun's corpse has been caused by the pits of the rotting apricots that have fallen in the church graveyard. The apricot pits have released a gas into the soil that preserves the bodies buried there. He proves this by revealing that everybody in the churchyard has been similarly preserved. When he leaves, the town is looking at him like he just pissed in their punch bowl. I loved the notion of a holy man whose lot it is to go around and destroy other people's faith. What must that do to one's own faith? My meeting on the Disney Studios lot in Burbank that day was with Megan Walpert from Spyglass Films and Suzanne Patmore from Touchstone. It was scheduled for 1 hour, but it ran 3. A very good sign. They were fascinated with my Herbert Thurston first edition and how it connected with what they wanted from the show. It made the whole thing feel fated, which was, of course, my plan all along. By the end of the meeting, it was decided I would work with Megan to develop a 1-hour pilot based on the Miracles movie script. I hadn't been hired, mind you. That's not the way it works. I would spend countless hours developing and writing a pitch that I would deliver to the top executives at Touchstone and also eventually ABC. This would take a couple of months. Then, if and only if ABC liked it, would I be officially hired to write the script. Until then, I'd be working for free. If they didn't like it, we'd all shake hands, and I'd go home without a penny to show for the work I'd done. This is how the television business works. As it turns out, back then in 2001, the Writers Guild did not go on strike, so I spent my days hanging out in coffee houses trying to somehow reduce and reshape the 2-hour movie script into a 1-hour TV pilot. The goal was to retain the emotion of the film, but in the final act, bring in a revelation that implies what Paul has been investigating is more sinister than he or the townspeople originally thought. This draws the attention of the Vatican, and Paul is quickly reassigned to a secret group within the Catholic Church that has been tracking supernatural events for over 1,000 years. And they now believe that generations of signs and symbols and mysterious happenings are pointing to a cataclysmic event that only they can stop, if they can figure it out in time. And guys, this was 2 years before the Da Vinci Code. Now, I had never written a television pilot. The process of television writing was new to me, but Megan at Spyglass became my guide, my muse, and my boogeyman, cajoling, encouraging, and ass-kicking me in equal measures. And it was exactly what I needed. Once we got the thumbs up from Tom Sherman at ABC, I figured I had at least 6 months to write a 1-hour script. My plan was to do what I always did when hired to write a movie, fuck around for about 4 months, spend my commencement money, and then when panic finally overtook me, go into a crazed shame spiral of fear and self-hatred and crap out a draft in 4 weeks. Hey, it had always worked before. Megan disabused me of that notion fast. Television is an actual job, with many regular steps and due dates. I was expected to write an outline that they would actually read. What the serious fuck was that about? Why not just come to my house and sit on the edge of my bed and bang 2 pots together every morning at 6 a.m.? Megan was a smart, gorgeous, funny, creative dynamo. But as the days went by, in my mind, she slowly morphed into the drill sergeant from Full Metal Jacket. She would email me almost every day, checking on how things were going, and I gotta say, it started to drive me crazy. How are things going? How are things going? Let me tell you how things are going. Very, very poorly. It was now June 2001. My younger son Spencer had just turned 3, and my older son Owen was turning 5. But the tension and stress and obvious unhappiness of their mom and dad was growing. The idea that the marriage might not last was becoming a reality, to me at least, and it was scary. If we did break up, even if I thought it was for the best, it would still be the worst thing I could imagine, especially since my whole view of the marriage was based on me saving her. This would be failure on such a massive scale, it was unthinkable. On the other hand, if saving her was a fucked up notion to begin with, maybe it was better to declare defeat, retreat, and try to figure out who I really was and what I really owed a partner. It wasn't something we could talk about. The pain and fear and anger and disappointment was so thick between us that to attack it head on would be like lighting a match while standing waist deep in a room filled with gasoline. Everyone was treading carefully, but I think we both sensed that something big and bad was about to hit us, and neither of us knew how to get out of its path or exactly when the impact would come. So I worked on miracles every day. It was like starting an exercise routine. It was difficult and painful, but it grounded me. It gave me a way to get through my days. Small steps, small accomplishments. Here, Megan, I outlined Act 1. Praise me. Oh, please praise me, because if you come at me harsh, I will collapse in on myself like a paper cup. Did she know? She must have. Either way, I got nothing but kindness and encouragement from her. And steady pressure. When could she expect Act 2? Act 3? Suzanne Patmore at Touchstone said something about receiving a completed outline by the end of July. Did that sound okay with me? No, 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 no. That did not sound okay. I could barely get out of bed in the morning. I was lucky to cobble together 2 hours of meaningful work a day. Usually it was way less. I was seeing my therapist 3 times a week at that point, and each of those visits was like a barely reachable oasis in a vast desert of weakness, fear, and mounting grief. But as the writing progressed, a sort of miracle happened. The same kind that always happens. The writing itself became the oasis. Those few hours a day, when I could sink into the story, were the only time in the day I wasn't in pain. Writing, when it goes well, is a very powerful narcotic. Filming had ended on the Mothman Prophecies. One morning, I received a call from the Writers Guild. My writing credit was being challenged by the 2 writers Mark Pellington had worked with on set. These were guys he'd worked with before. It was a creative relationship with history, and it was how he was most comfortable working. I had no choice in the matter. The strange part was, they really hadn't changed the script. Some scenes in the very beginning of the movie had been changed a little, but nothing of the plot or theme or character relationships. They added some dialogue, including some lines that people still quote as their favorites, like when Alexander Leak assesses the supernatural visitors to Point Pleasant by remarking, quote, "Their motivations are not human." I hadn't been offended by any of the changes they'd made. They were respectful and minor, and they clearly understood what I was trying to do, so I was shocked and deeply threatened when they brought the script to the WGA for arbitration. According to WGA rules, a panel of 3 guild members would read all drafts with no names attached, and then make a decision on who got credit. I can't express to you how terrifying this was to me. This movie meant everything to me. Everything in it, every character, every scene, every moment felt like a reflection of myself, my one true chance to put myself out there in the world and say, "This is me." I felt like my very identity was being threatened. I was already in freefall in my marriage. Now this, it felt unsurvivable. Part of the guild's process is to have each of the writers in the arbitration write a statement indicating what they think the credit should be and why. So, as if my life depended on it, I painstakingly went through my draft and their draft and built a case as best I could for why I should receive sole credit. This was agony, because it required me to stand up for myself in a clear, articulate way at a time when I felt incapable of being assertive. But I had no choice. So I wrote my document and submitted it and then waited. I was told the process of deliberation could take months. As the end of July drew closer, I finally had to tell Megan that I wouldn't be done. And even worse, I was leaving town. We were going to Hawaii, a trip that had been booked months earlier and now seemed like a sick joke, a parody of a happy family vacation. But at least there'd be distractions, and could it really be any worse than staying at home? Of course it could. We tried. We really, truly did our best on that trip to be patient with each other and the kids. But it was surreal to be so sad and hurting and anxious and mad in a tropical paradise. Piña coladas don't have very much alcohol in them, and that was only the beginning of the bad news. On our second day, Megan emailed me in a panic. Touchstone was expecting the outline at the end of the week, and there was no way Spyglass was going to say no. I'd have to finish it in the next few days. Fine. In fact, the very next day, I ended up finishing it in one long 12-hour push, while my wife took the kids to the zoo and the aquarium and all the other places parents take small children to kill a day. And it was during those 12 hours that miracles died in front of me. Page by page, word by word, the colors faded and the pace flagged and the emotions dried up and floated away. It was fast hack work. I was just jamming events into place with no ability to make them come to life. They just sat there, inert. Every scene was a placeholder. But I finished it, and I sent it off, way after closing time in Los Angeles. And then I spent the rest of the trip in scalding shame, waiting for Megan's phone call. But when our time in Hawaii was finally up, she hadn't called. Now fear replaced shame. I should call her and say something, make some excuse. But there was this small craven part of me that hoped somehow it wasn't as bad as I thought it was. Maybe somehow she didn't hate it. Maybe I'd fooled them one more time. On the flight home, Owen got an earache and screamed for 4 straight hours. The hatred radiating toward me in waves from the other passengers felt good. It made sense. I deserved it. August 15th, 2001 was the day everything changed. My wife and I had lunch scheduled with my parents. They were dying to hear about Hawaii. And we actually did a really admirable job of making it sound like we had a wonderful time. Anyone who's been married will understand this. The ability to ignore a bad time, a bad mood, or even something truly awful, at least for a while. You can even have some really good times as the ship is going down. That lunch was one of the last. Later that afternoon, in fact, not even an hour after we were back from lunch, something lit a fuse, and from out of nowhere, we ramped up from tense words into a screaming fight. But before it really settled into one of our long, endless gutter squalls, she surprised me. "I think one of us needs to move out," she said. I was horrified. This was a crazy escalation. But she said it so quietly and calmly, I was completely thrown off balance. Then I realized she had just handed me what I'd been too chicken shit to demand for myself: a way out. After what felt like half my life, but which was only about 2 seconds, I said, "Okay." And then for the next 2 hours, we had a calm, constructive discussion about how it should work. I'd be the one moving out. But since this was about us getting distance from each other and not the kids, we decided to have the kids spend half their time with me. That would actually give us both breathing room, time with the boys and time alone. 1 week on, 1 week off. The turnover would be Fridays after daycare. Monday nights would be dinner with the opposite parent. We would basically co-parent from 2 different houses. There was a kind of relief that afternoon. Finally, we were both at least agreeing on things. It was nice to cooperate even when what we were cooperating on was the beginning of the end of our marriage. But we also agreed to start marriage counseling, because we wanted a safe place to bring our issues, stuff we'd barely talked about without fighting. We would, in a sense, step out of the gasoline-filled room. We'd bring the scariest stuff out into the open and then see if it was solvable. I didn't think it was, but I wasn't sure. And I guess that's as good a description of hope as any. The feeling of relief only lasted a day. Then an overwhelming sense of failure swept over me, unlike anything I'd ever felt in my life. Massive, drowning failure. In whatever way I thought my relationship was about me saving my wife, I clearly had not saved her. Whatever thing inside me screamed that this was the most important thing to do in my life, I now knew I had not done and never would. Anger came in. It's her fault. She's unsavable. She's being purposely unsavable to destroy me. I felt rage, then depression, then fear, then rage again. Sometimes it took days to cycle from one to the next, sometimes minutes. I looked for a house to rent not too far away, somewhere with a bedroom for the boys and a backyard, somewhere that wouldn't make the situation feel even more scary and depressing, at least for them. I eventually found a nice place in the flats below Altadena and submitted an application. The landlord was a pediatrician, and when she met Owen and Spencer, it was a done deal. I made plans to move in the first week of October. But what happened with miracles? A miracle. My shitty outline turned out to be a non-issue. Before Megan even turned it into Touchstone, there was a new controversy that had to be dealt with. The director who had been attached, a guy named John Turteltaub, who had directed National Treasure and Phenomenon, he was dropping out. I had no idea why, but it took a while for Touchstone to work through the fallout and reassess the status of the pilot, which in late August was very much in question. Megan told me not to worry. Until Touchstone got the Turteltaub of it all settled, nothing was happening. I got a breather. The Tuesday after Labor Day, September 4th, 2001, I got a call from the Writers Guild. The arbitration committee had finally made their ruling. I would receive sole credit for the Mothman prophecies. The decision had been unanimous. I felt like my body, which had been racked with pain for months, was suddenly shot through with morphine. The next day, Lakeshore cut me a check for my sole credit bonus. It would be enough to get me through the next 6 months, which was about five more months into my future than I could even imagine. The Mothman Prophecies was scheduled to come out in January. Would it be a hit? Would it be well received? What was going to happen with my pilot? What was going to happen with my marriage? All these questions hung in the air, their answers just out of reach. The check from Lakeshore arrived on the afternoon of Monday, September 10th. I opened it, then took it outside with me, and sat on our patio with a gin and tonic and a plate of Ritz crackers, and watched the sunset behind the tall pines across the street from what would soon be the house I used to live in. I sipped my drink and took a deep breath. For the first time in months, it felt like things just might turn out okay. Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Please join me next week for Miracles, Part 2. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers, Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producer is Tess Feifel, and our sound designer, engineer, and editor is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver, website is by Kayla Lord, and our music, as always, is by Nima Kazarumi. Until next time, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.